Gdzie Holland here? Ja nie wierzę.
In English, Nana, tell me.
In English, so?
What is your name?
I don't know the name of him.
No, your name. What is your name?
Tanya.
Okay. I'm Nina Porzuki. This is The World in Words, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. And that was my grandmother, Tanya Porzuki. Today on the podcast, we're going to continue talking about talking to our grandparents. Last week, we featured Yowei Shaw's story.
I have a problem. As much as I want to, I can't communicate with my grandpa Ye Ye. He only speaks Mandarin Chinese, and I pretty much only speak English. So our conversations start simple and stay simple.
Okay, if you haven't heard the entire story, stop the podcast now, go back and listen. I promise you will not regret it. It's great. So when I heard Yowei's story, I couldn't help but think of my own grandmother, Tanya. Growing up, we actually had no problems communicating. She speaks English and Polish and Russian and German and Yiddish and Hebrew and a smattering of Lithuanian. But a few years ago, she had a series of strokes, and then dementia set in.
What do you remember?
None.
Nothing?
No. И делала так, чтобы можно было.
Her languages have gotten all mixed up. She's stuck in this linguistic fog. And nobody in my family can really find our way through. Not one of us speaks Polish or Russian or whatever combination of languages that she's speaking. My father.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Did you have coffee? Her only son has learned a couple of words.
Well, you know, my mother always said that when people revert to some language, the words that they really usually know are the kind of the curse words. There's a couple of curse words that she uses.
Oh, no.
Especially when she's upset or mad, she'll use the word dupa.
Dupa.
And I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but it means ass or, yeah, stupid ass, so to speak.
Dupa. What else have you learned?
When she was kind of going to recovery, and we would try to get her to do something, she would use the word nemagu. I can't do that. Nemagu.
Nemagu.
More recently, when I get her to walk, she would say, idiom, let's go, idiom. And she would lead us, and she'd say, idiom.
I know that I learned, she always says, хорошо, which means good in Russian. Хорошо, хорошо.
And, хорошо and так.
Так. And also, что? I think she's always saying "sto."
Sto, yeah, sto.
And then she says "pachimu."
Pachimu, which means why? Why are you doing this?
Pachimu.
Why are you saying that? Or you know, pachimu.
So the grandmother that I could always communicate with, the voracious reader, the one who told me that I hadn't really lived until I had read Dostoevsky in Russian, can no longer really speak to me in anything but. And I began to be curious. What was happening inside her brain that made the Russian and the Polish reappear and the English that she had spoken for the largest part of her life, really, recede? This, it turns out, is a very difficult question to answer. But there have, however, been a series of studies about the effects of bilingualism on dementia. One seminal study found that being bilingual might even stave off the symptoms of dementia for years.
It was totally to our amazement to discover a 4.5-year difference in the average age of symptom onset, simply as a function of whether or not these people were monolingual or bilingual. And that's a huge difference.
That's Ellen Bialstock, a psychology professor at York University in Canada. And in 2007, she published the formative study on bilingualism and dementia. She analyzed the medical records of bilinguals and monolinguals in Toronto, and she looked at a set of people all the same age, all diagnosed with dementia, to see when they first presented with recognizable symptoms. And what she found, that 4.5-year difference that she just spoke about, it created waves within the scientific community.
It's important to say they got dementia, but somehow they can function with the dementia at a higher level for a little bit longer.
So you got this result, 4.5 years on average. Yeah. Did you look into like the reasons why? Like why?
We're looking at that now. That's our main question. Why? What's going on? So we can speculate, but honestly, nobody really knows.
My birthday is the 15th of July. Yeah. 25.
My grandmother was born July 15th, 1925, in Vilnius, Poland, when it was Poland. She was the youngest of two, a spoiled child, she used to say. She learned how to read at a very young age. And one of the stories that she used to tell me was about two Polish spinster sisters who lived in her apartment building. They had this immense private library. And one day they lured her into the house and lent her a book. Now, I cannot for the life of me remember what book they lent her. I know she told me, but I never wrote it down. But this book sparked something inside her, turned her into a reader. And the sisters, they just kept feeding her one book after another, after another, after another. One speculation, according to Ellen Bielstock, about why there is that 4.5 year difference between bilinguals and monolinguals is that being bilingual helps to build up something that scientists and she call the cognitive reserve. Think of it almost like brain armor, like all those things that they tell us are good for the mind, Sudoku, crossword puzzles, St. John's wort. Learning another language contributes to this theoretical cognitive armor, that cognitive reserve, with loads and loads of caveats, according to another scientist, neuropsychologist Thomas Bach. He was pretty excited by Bielstock's study, and it's pretty apparent why.
Thomas, how many languages do you speak?
Well, Polish, German, English, French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, my mother was German, my father was Polish, so that explained it. Then English, of course, and Spanish, because my wife is from Spain and we speak Spanish at home.
But even though Bach, the polyglot, was dazzled by the results, 4.5 years, that is huge. Bach, the scientist at the University of Edinburgh, he had a few concerns.
So that was a paper which caused a lot of interest, but there is one big problem that you have there, that you have generally in countries where bilingualism is very often associated with immigration. Uh-huh. Namely, that most of the bilinguals were either immigrants themselves or first generation after immigration. So they might have had different ethnic background, different genetics, different lifestyle, food, for instance, diet, and so on and so on. So it's very difficult to be sure whether these differences were due to language or were due to any other factors.
The other problem, he says, education.
People who speak more than one language, they went to better schools. That's why they got, so to say, one extra language or two. And maybe the schools, the quality of education and so on is what in fact distinguishes the two groups.
So Bach set up his own study in Hyderabad, in India, to compare monolinguals and bilinguals with dementia. In India, he figured he could account for both of the problems he found in the Toronto study, immigration and education.
Hyderabad is a place which has been multilingual for the last 500 years, at least. Mm-hmm. So all our patients came from families which have been for generations in the area, so we didn't have at all any problems with the confound of immigration. So here you can see how looking at different populations can solve a problem what would be very difficult to solve, let's say in Toronto or Boston, is very easy to do in Hyderabad because simply there, bilingualism is not associated with immigration.
Uh-huh. So most people in the area are multilingual. They speak more than one
language. Well, about 60%. Ideally, to do this type of research, you need to have, let's say, around half-half.
So what did you find then that was different than the Toronto study?
Firstly, we confirmed the results from Toronto study, but without the immigration confound. So we could show relatively clearly that this is not caused by immigration. The second thing, which I think was very important, is, again, in Hyderabad, we are in a lucky situation to study it because you have hundreds of people who are illiterate and yet bilingual. So most people learn in Hyderabad, learn the languages not from school, but more or less from the street or from work and so on. So we were looking at a group of almost 200 illiterate people, and we found that in this group, the difference between bilinguals and monolinguals was even bigger than in the literate group. It was 6 years wow. delay. So it means that we can show with quite good certainty that this is not an effect of going to better schools, because you find this difference even in people who have never attended a school at all.
My grandmother never went to college. Though she came from a secular middle-class family, she probably would have gone. But she left school at the age of 17, when her family was relocated into the Vilna ghetto. I'm not sure what she would have wanted to study. Literature, perhaps?
My mom's? Yeah. My mom's doesn't live here anymore for a long time.
I know. But what is her name?
My name is Tanya.
Your name, but what was your mom's name?
My mom, Nina.
Nina, like me.
Yeah, Nina тоже. Нет, все будет хорошо.
Neuropsychologist Thomas Bach may have replicated Ellen Bialystok's results, but he was equally in the dark as to the why. What is really going on in the bilingual brain that helps control dementia symptoms?
Of course, you will find different theories. What is at the moment clearly the kind of the predominant theory is that being bilingual means that you have to switch between the languages. You have to activate one, suppress the other, and then reactivate the other. So let's say when I speak to you, I know that I have to use English. If I'm speaking to someone who, let's say, knows English and Polish, I can use words from both languages and that will be okay. If I speak to my wife, I can speak Polish and mix it with Spanish. But if I speak to my mother-in-law, I have to use only Spanish because she will not understand any English. So when you are bilingual, you practically always adjust exactly your verbal output to what you know about the person you are communicating with. And the, let's say, predominant idea is that this is a permanent, so to say, exercise for what we call frontal executive functions. So for the kind of higher level control functions in the brain. So in a way, without being conscious of it, a bilingual is always using this kind of switching techniques, whereas as a monolingual, you don't have to do it because you simply speak just in one language. So that is, at the moment, I would say, the predominant hypothesis.
It's not easy, all this stuff, you know. You have to remember.
So when in dementia, what is happening to your brain that makes that ability to be able to switch useful for getting around?
It is still an area of intense research. So, you know, whatever I can tell you what is, so to say, state of the art today, but it could be that in 5 or 10 years, we will have different views.
Sure.
But my view on the basis of what we know so far is that the big difference in dementia is not so much about remembering things in terms of knowledge, it's about accessing this information.
Uh-huh.
So the bilinguals might also have, let's say, problems in forgetting something, but they will be better accessing it because of their better frontal executive functions.
And when I asked him my original question, why has my grandmother chosen to fall back into one language and not another, Bach was equally as perplexed. There isn't much, if any, scientific study as to why one language takes hold and other languages are lost to dementia. However, there are many, many anecdotes and case studies, he told me. Oh, that noise you hear in the background? That's his multilingual daughter. She only speaks 4 languages.
The oldest rule, which has been described by a Frenchman called Ribot in 19th century, is that people revert to their original language. So basically, they go back to their first language that they learned as children. But this is not the unique phenomenon. So you have a few years later, something else described by Pitre, so also in France, late 19th century. And he said, well, it might be the language which is mainly spoken for the last 10, 20 years of the life.
For my grandmother, it isn't. And it isn't exactly her first language either. Her first language is Polish. And then later, when the Russians occupied Vilnius in 1939, Russian. Something about the Russian stuck. Another theory that Bach told me was that a person might revert to a language that they spoke during a moment in their life, when they felt immense joy or satisfaction or comfort. I can't imagine that 1939 was a particularly calm time in my grandmother's life. She was 15. There was war on the brink, not to mention the hormonal war starting inside her. But then perhaps this was one of the last periods of her life when she truly felt comfort, when her family was still together, still in their same apartment buildings with the old Polish ladies lending her books. Perhaps this was when she started reading the Russians in Russian.
There are so many different aspects which play a role, and cognitive as well as emotional. So it's not that we are kind of making just, you know, computer decisions. The attitude that we have, the beliefs, the hopes.
No, it's fascinating that it is emotional too, that it's all interconnected. The brain, the final frontier.
Memory is a funny thing. It's selective, as they say. And why our brain chooses to latch onto one thing or another, one language or another, there's something in that mystery that, and I don't mean to be dramatic, but it's almost poetic. And when I think about my grandmother's deteriorating mind, her memories evaporating, of course she's retreated back into a language and a moment before the disappearing in her life began. For a radio producer, I was terrible about recording my grandmother before the dementia set in. But I do have one video that I love. A little snippet of a Yiddish children's song she used to sing as a girl. I leave you with that today. You've been listening to The World in Words, and a few bits of business to share with you. First, we have a new logo. It's so exciting. Thank you so much to Stefan Millette here at WGBH, who worked on this brand new logo for you and for us. We're really excited. Thank you, Stefan. And in the next few weeks, we're going to be revamping the podcast a bit. There's more fun stuff to come. And Patrick and I just wanted to ask you, if you like this podcast, if you want to hear more, if you could just go to iTunes, leave a little review. It really helps. Okay, that's all for now. I'm Nina Porzucki. You can catch me on Twitter at Porzucki. That's P-O-R-Z-U-C-K-I. And, yep, thanks for listening.
I love you.
Я так это есть, вот мои миоды. Я не могла даже, ты знаешь, не как кончила.
Can I get a kiss?
What?
Kiss.
Oh.
Mwah. Can I kiss you?
Oh, bubble.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.